You're listening to the Irish Times Roisin Meets podcast.
Welcome back to Roisin Meets. My guest today is Zayuddin Yousafzai, the father of Nobel Prize winner and all-round brilliant feminist icon for young girls and women alike, Malala. For over 20 years, Zayuddin has been fighting for equality, first for Malala and then for all girls throughout the world living in patriarchal societies. Taught as a young boy in Pakistan to believe that he was inherently better than his sisters, Zayuddin rebelled against inequality at a young age. And when he had a daughter himself, he vowed that she would have an education. And he did that by founding a school in Pakistan that Malala and other girls could attend. But as you probably know, in 2012, Malala was shot for standing up to the Taliban by continuing to go to school. And Zayuddin has written a memoir called Let Her Fly. And I was delighted he came into the studio to speak to me about it and about his extraordinary daughter. Zayuddin, I'm so pleased you could join me on this podcast. We met a few years ago when Malala got an award here in Ireland, and I kind of knew then in a weird way I would see you again sometime. So it's a real pleasure.
It is happening right now. Thank you so much.
The book is wonderful. And first of all, just before we go into it, just to ask how Malala is now. She's studying in Oxford. So what's her current status? Because people will be interested.
She's good. Rather fantastic, doing very well. She is in the second year of her college. She's in Oxford LMH, which is called Lady Margaret Hall. She's studying PPE, philosophy, politics, and economics. And socially, she is very Oxonian. Oxonian means Oxfordian, how can I say it? And the best thing is that I feel that she has rediscovered her happiness and life in Oxford, because she has a bigger space there to walk and talk to people, to attend seminars, parties, conferences, lectures. So she's so busy. And to be short, we miss her more than she misses us. It's a complaint. It's a complaint and a comfort at the same time. Yeah, she's doing very well.
That's great. Well, send her our regards, and hopefully one day she can come here as well.
Yes, of course.
You'll put in a good word for us. I know you will. But listen, I want to talk about you, because the book is really your story. You obviously were very much involved in Malala's book, which was out 4 years ago, and telling of that story. But this is from your perspective, which makes it very interesting, because you have such a close relationship with Malala and always have done. But also, you've had this incredible feminist journey, which I'd love to talk to you about too. So take us back to your childhood, when you were a boy growing up with one brother and lots of sisters who didn't really get a look in.
Yeah, so I grew up in a village in the northwest of Pakistan. It's called Barkana is my village name. Very small community. Maybe at that time it had some 150 houses in total. Surrounded by beautiful tall mountains and a river. I grew up in a very natural environment, like full of natural beauty with all its cataracts and springs and rivers and mountains and lush green fields a little bit. And I grew up in this family. I had five sisters and a brother. And right from the very beginning, I was very important person to my family because I was a boy, simply. Next door to our home was our uncle, and he had four sons and no daughter. And my father, he used to say something that there is spring and here is autumn, because he thought that the house that has spring has more boys, and the house where autumn prevails, it has more daughters. So such things were happening in my childhood. And what I could see, one thing was my own importance, being a boy. Too much concentration and focus on me in terms of everything, like food, clothing, very nice, beautiful conversation with me of my both parents. If I get a little bit ill, straight away to doctor. Even in terms of shoes, I had more pair of shoes than my sisters. Better food than my sisters. Like if a chicken was prepared. So the sumptuous part was eaten by me. And the wings, not now wings are very popular at that time, are the less...
The bonier parts
went to the girls, and they used to eat at the end, and we at first. And but the most, drastic or harmful discrimination that was done to my sisters, that I went to school, my older brother had schooling, and my five sisters were not educated and they were not sent to school. My parents were not interested in their education at all, and it was like a social norm. If you don't send your girl to school, it's fine. If you send, it is like doing something very conspicuous, like doing something something new, if not strange, that you send your girl to school. So they were comfortable with it. And for me, they had big, tall dreams that this boy, even he stammers and he's not like...
This is handsome, you, like, if you had a stammer.
Yeah, not handsome like his sisters, but still he's a boy and he will be a great boy. He will be a doctor. He will be... he will have a name in the society, in the community. So that's why I tell people that if I had been one of my five sisters, or if I had been sixth daughter to my parents, because there was autumn, so the world would have never heard of me. And even my own community would have never heard of me after I was becoming 12 or 13 years old, because as the girls enter into their puberty, they are limited and confined to the four walls of the house.
I just think you say it really well, but I found it very moving when you actually mention all your sisters by name in the book, because, and you did that deliberately, because their names would not be mentioned. You wouldn't even necessarily hear about them in the house or elsewhere, except in relation to where they're getting married or who they were going to marry. And you named your sisters there, which is a very nice thing to do.
You're asking about that I didn't know the names of mine?
No, I'm saying that in the book, you name them.
Of course.
I found that very moving. Because...
Yeah, that is so important, because I believe that the first thing that comes is the name. I named Malala Yousafzai after Malala of Maywan because she had her own name. And she is the most well-known, popular Pashtun legendary heroine in Pashtun and Afghan history, that she is known by her own name. Nobody says Malala, Mr. So-and-so's daughter or Mr. So-and-so's fiancé. So one of the biggest attraction in her name was that she had her own identity. And I think that the first thing for girls, that their names should be mentioned. I remember that when I had to go with my mother to doctors as an escort, because usually women are accompanied by men members, even sometimes a small boy. And I used to go with my mother to a doctor. And the doctor, when he was writing the prescription for my mother, I see on prescription Ziauddin's mother, mother of Ziauddin. If she had been taken by my father, I used to see wife of Mr. Ruhul Amin. It's my father's name. So you can understand that I was very conscious to these small things. The first thing you give to somebody is name and identity. And as my sisters were not in school and their name, I had never seen on any detail mark certificate or any school certificate. So when I was applying for the Canadian visa, I didn't know their surname or first name. I knew only one name. And then I had to ask them. And then I wrote. So anyway, it is so important.
Yeah. So I'm interested, though, as you, a little boy, observing these things, because these things were normal to you. You were important. You were special. Your sisters were not so much. They had to eat the bony bits. And when tea was served, you know, it was this big ritual involving your dad. And if he didn't like the tea was sent back and all that kind of thing. some people would just go, yes, this is right. I am very important and the girls aren't as important. What was it that sowed the seeds that there was something wrong with this picture? And I know there was a couple of very dramatic things, but do you think from the beginning you noticed it and kind of went, I don't really think this is right?
I think the main reason of that change in thinking, there are two reasons. Number one, I was also discriminated by some people in a different way. Like I was bullied by my cousins and my my peer groups, like the of my age boys, because of my dark color, my stammering. They used to mimic me, and it was so offensive as a child. If you do now, I'm fine. But at that time,
I promise I won't.
Yeah, at that time, I used to get very offended and embarrassed.
Yeah.
And feeling a complex that I'm inferior to them, they can speak fluently, I can't speak. So I saw those discriminations even in school, like sometimes one or two, three teachers, I had inspiring teachers as well, inspirational teachers as well, but there were few who were not I can say not good, that they used to have discrimination within the same class among the students. Like students who belonged to the rich families, they were taken more care of, or who were handsome in appearance were taken more care of. And a student like me having big nose at that time, I'm still big nose, but I was conscious of it. And dark in color was ignored. And I was so conscious about that. And I remember that one teacher, I love him and I always remember him in good words, that when I was in grade 5, we had that science examination, and what he did, I did it very well, and he took my examination paper and he moved in all classrooms. I was in for the first time in the high school. I was in grade 6, I think, yeah. And he moved in all classrooms and showed it to students and teachers. And then I realized that, okay, this physical appearance is not the only thing.
Right.
Do you have something more which you can build on? If you are able, if you work on your intelligence and your brain and mind, you can have some space in society or you can be acknowledged for that.
But the point is that because you had that discrimination yourself, because of your stammer, because I don't believe this, you weren't handsome, but anyway, maybe compared to other people. But the idea that you knew what it felt like.
Yeah, so I'm coming back. I speak for so long.
No, it's okay. I'll bring you back.
I come back to your point that as I saw discriminations myself, so that changed me about anything that was happening to other people because of their poverty, because of their social status. Even we had this, this is so sad to share with you, like in community, in our communities, social infrastructure. This is so sad that the carpenters, the barbers, the masons, they don't have the same respect as the land owners. Are the doctors, are teachers. Mm. So they are looked down upon because of their professions. So I was very conscious of that. And I wrote a long poem for them. I praised all of them that I exist because of them.
Wow.
We are all equal human beings. Yeah. And I cursed caste system in that poem. So I was seeing all those things. So when it came to gender inequality, I was very conscious about that as well.
But on an even more serious level, you had a cousin who was attacked and you saw an honor killing too. Can you explain about those things? I think they, from the book, they seem to have had a very big impact on you.
That was something, it's human nature, I can say, that when you see bad things and when you hear about them, that is one impact. But when you personally go through them, or if somebody who is near and dear to you, like cousin or son or daughter, or somebody goes through that situation, then you feel it. Your empathy grows and you practically come up with solution, or you practically come up with this campaign against it. So my cousin's attack was really, I can say, a very turning point in my life, that I became very conscious and became very, very, very much shocked that why a woman, a girl who has been married and bound in a forced marriage, and now she's not happy with husband who is kind, a little bit mad person, and she wants to be out of that forced marriage. And she's unable to do that because even if she goes to the court, the social pressure is such a huge thing that she withdrew her case from the court because some of the elders went to her brother and told her, oh, you should just withdraw this case of divorce seeking from the guy. It is like a stigma. It is not in our culture and it is not in our tradition. Once a woman is married, she's married for all. Like once one dies, she dies for all. So there is no way out of it. And it is against social norm that if you seek this freedom from that bond of marriage. So it was really very shocking for me. And that's why I was with her, as it's mentioned in the book. Even when she was practicing those superstitious things, I was helping her. I knew that it will be not working, but just for her sake, I used to go with her that if it's a comfort for her. So all these things were happening, really.
So you met your wife quite young.
Yeah.
And it was, even though it was a so-called arranged marriage, it was a love match as well, because from the first time you saw her.
Yeah, she's still beautiful, very beautiful. But at that time, as she was a teenager, I can say, yeah, she was so beautiful that I had this complex that, as I said, that I'm not handsome. And when such a beautiful girl comes in your life and she makes you realize that, no, you are worth, you are good, you are important, it was huge for me in many respects. Like it bring me a kind of confidence in my personality, in myself. And she came close to me, like we used to sit together. But she never expressed that she loves me. But love is something that you can feel it, you can understand it. I should not teach you. But it is something that we could see that infatuation and that falling in love for each other. She didn't express much, but through my dead cousin, she used to convey her messages to me, who was shot. So... that was kind of a thing that when I was in year 9, so it started from 8, 9. And then she was in my mind and in my heart. I could not meet her all the time. It was the only occasion used to be when she used to come to my aunt's home. Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen all the time. So what I did when I went to college, I kept a picture of an artist. Salma Agha was her name. And she looked like her. So I used to look at her.
Because it would have been improper for you to have a picture of her. Is that it?
She didn't give me the picture.
Oh,
I sent my nephew.
So you had this
and
look-alike.
She told me she was more practical. And she told my nephew that it doesn't work like this. He should send his family and parents.
But you know, she was...
because she didn't want to have like being just getting a bad name or having a scandal without having the boy. So yeah. She's very practical. So
yeah, and her name is Turpakai, we should say. Is that, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes, Turpakai.
Yeah. Yes. She was a kind of interesting person. It's interesting that you found each other because although she'd been brought up in that very patriarchal society that you've described so well, she at the same time was someone who liked to do her own thing. I mean, there's one point where she tells her friends, she's walking past you and she says to her friends, I'm going to greet him, which is a big deal,
of course.
Just to say hello to a boy on the street.
Yes.
And she did that. So that sort of marked her out to me from an early bit as someone who would do things. And when you were married, there was somebody coming to visit you and she said she was going to put some makeup on and you were a bit annoyed about this. Yeah. Why are you putting on makeup on for someone else? She said, excuse me, it's my house, I'll put on makeup. And also you, when you were married, I use this word let in inverted commas, but your wife was allowed by you, or you were happy for her to go off to the market on her own, which was again quite unusual.
Yes.
And she was willing to do it. So I think it's interesting reading the book. I definitely feel the two of you came together and it was, you know, I know it was chemistry at the beginning, but there was obviously something else going on that attracted you to each other, that you were the right people for each other.
Yes, I think I was a free soul and she was a free soul.
Yeah.
That was the common thing. Because later on when she shared her life stories with me, that how she was very much mindful and very much sad about this situation, that when she will be growing 13, 14 and she will be once for all inside the house and she won't be able to see the rest of the world, because she used to go out of home a lot. Like some people used to criticize that, oh, Torpeke, she's walking here and there and goes to the houses of different cousins and close family friends, and she's most often seen here and there, and she was kind of lady, kind of girl who was very free soul.
Yeah.
So that was common thing, and she was kind of girl who could see in people beyond their physical appearance. Because I'm dead sure there were a lot of other men and boys who were...
with smaller noses.
Smaller noses, very handsome. But she chose for me.
Yeah.
And the reason was that I was very popular and famous schoolboy.
Mm-hmm. Did she like that?
She liked that I was... I used to stand first in my class.
Yeah.
I was a speaker and debater. So like a small community of 200 houses, like 2,000 or 10,000 people in different small communities here and there. And then you are a very famous person. And she loved that aspect of me. So... yeah, I was for about her beauty.
Yeah,
and she thought I was an intelligent man, though I was not. But I mean, like, I looked like that.
let's talk about your life when you moved to Swat Valley, which is a beautiful part of Pakistan. And your dream was to create a school. I mean, your thing was education from a young man. You had this vision, and she very much supported you in that. So at what stage, when Malala was born, where were you with all that? Was the school built yet, or were you...
The school was born before Malala was born.
Okay.
Initially, when I completed my education, I did master. I, for some months, I tried to seek a government teaching job, but it didn't happen. Then I taught in a private school, independent school, and I learned a lot in that school. It was a very good school. And then I thought that why not open the school, which I run myself independently, because there you can cater all the dreams and vision you have, like it's you, and the things you want to do, you're free. The kind of school you want to have, you're free. So because of that freedom, like the dream of freedom in an institution, I was lucky. A friend was with me, and we, in partnership, we started a school. And I then realized that, yes, this is a great opportunity. And this will not be just a school to teach children mathematics or sciences. Computer was not at that time. So, but it will be a kind of school that it will be a center of an excellence and a center of social change. So that's why I involved parents a lot in my school activities. I used to do a lot of school activities like annual days, parents' days, mother days, to involve community more and more in schooling, and individual counseling with children. With girls and boys, what are your problems back at home? Tell me, I will then call your mother and father. So I loved teaching in my school. That was my paradise, to be honest. And this is how it started. Malala born in 1997, and the school was 3 years old when she was born.
Okay, and you have two sons as well, I should say, who are also very much part of your book and your story, and
yes,
we'll talk about them. But you definitely say when Malala was born, you saw almost a glittering in her eye that you...
Yes.
And as she grew and developed and became... She was so interested in learning. There was this spark in her.
Yes.
You're very much... you saw that from an early age, that it was something special or...
Yeah, for me, her birth was like the rise of a morning star, to be honest. The glittering and the shining I saw in her eyes... I tell people that I didn't see many newborn children, babies, but I had seen few, and we have a religious tradition that when a baby is born, so we give a call of prayer in his or her ear.
Okay.
And I did that for a few babies. You see? like you say, God is great, God is great, and then come to the success and about the Prophet Muhammad. So this is the first thing it is done for a baby. I did for babies. And when I saw her, I was seeing that this is not a newborn baby, as she had a week, born week ago, with these open eyes, like stars, very shining. And that was the moment that my heart was filled, like it was full, and it was blessed with kind of joy, which I had never experienced in my whole life.
And when Asmalala got older and she went to your school then, which is great, you were able to have her educated there.
Yes.
I mean, it was so important for you as a girl that she get everything that your sons were going to get too, because of the way your awakening that you'd had, the way that your sisters were discriminated against, you were going to make sure she didn't have that. She was very academic from an early age, wasn't she? And your sons not so much so. She was definitely different to them.
This is very interesting that she was so academic right from the day one. Like, we were living adjacent to school, and when the children used to go out of school, she being in the lap of my friend or her mother or a teacher sometime, she used to talk to the empty chairs. Like, she grew up in school. So the school was her home and the home was her school. So in such an environment, she was, even when she was a toddler, so she was about education. And she started speaking, like, not speaking, talking, I can say. She started talking before she could walk.
Okay.
Yeah, so she was a very eloquent right from the day one. And she was so fond of her school, and so much caring about her school, that she was very small, maybe 5-6 years old, that when she used to come from home. So we had this white scarf in summer and black scarf which goes around the head. And she used to wash it for herself to make it fresh every second, third day. Washing her socks herself with her small hands. I never told her, our mother never told her to do all those things. And even she has the record. She has all the record of her examination papers from nursery and KG. Can you imagine? And I still have those papers. All those examination papers.
She kept those. I mean, you had this trophy at home full of her school trophies.
She only asked me to bring a file, a folder.
Really?
That was it. Yes. I don't have any of my stuff as a student.
That's amazing.
But she was so caring and so in love with her education that she treasured every certificate, every examination paper, every detailed master certificate. I still have all of them.
So tell me about the Taliban coming, because it sounds like, you know, you were living your dream. You'd set up this school. You were educating girls and boys. You had this extraordinary child and two sons and everything was great. That was a huge devastation for your whole community.
And you said it very well, and I should pick your words. Like, it was a very beautiful dream of change for the family, for the community, through education. And Taliban were a nightmare for that dream. We had all our expectations pinned on education, that my daughter Malala and many other girls, 500 girls, and not only those 500 girls, there were 50,000 girls, that these girls will be achieving and getting their education. They will be accomplishing great things once they are out of schools and colleges and universities. And all of a sudden, these people come and they say, no girls' education. They bombed more than 400 schools. And finally, it was devastating, that they announced on their FM radio in December 2008 that after January 2009, 14th January 2009, no girl would be allowed to go to school, young or old. And when they spread that bad word on their FM radio, girls started stopping to come to school. Their parents did not allow them to be coming to school. But some of the girls were so resilient and so brave. I remember one morning, a girl came an hour late to school, and like all principals and teachers do, I was standing at the door. Why are you late? Why are you not on time? And she told me that my father and brothers were not allowing me to come to school. But when they went out for their shops, I just sneaked out to come to school.
Wow.
So such brilliant girls were there, and they were so fond and love of education.
And one of those brilliant girls was Malala. And she became, this is sort of the root of her activism, really, and your activism too, even though your activism had been happening just by virtue of building the school. You'd been doing that, you and your wife, because she was very involved too in getting girls and getting communities, parents to bring their girls to school.
Exactly,
so in behind the scenes, she was doing a lot. But how did Malala become an activist? And obviously that led then to her being shot. Were we talking about a couple of years in which she was communicating with this outside world, telling people what was happening
this
there?
This is a story of a few years because we say like father, like daughter. So as I loved speaking and doing debates and speeches, she also, being a student of in the same school, I was very much focused on students' confidence building through speaking, like taking part in skits and sketches and drawing and painting and debates and declamation contests. It was the silent features of my school. And along with other girls, she was becoming like a speaker, a debater. We had a lot of debate competitions. So what used to be happening, teacher used to write small speeches for the lower grade children, and they used to memorize it and then speak. But my strategy was that later when they grow old, they will write for themselves. Mm. They will put their own thoughts in favor or against a subject. So this was kind of activity. But when this Talibanization happened in Swat and girls' education became like a taboo that nobody should go to school. And Taliban discouraged girls' education in the beginning. And then, as I mentioned, bombing of the schools and then complete ban on girls' education. At that very time, media, national and international media, started taking interest in Swat for the bad news, I can say, to have news, to highlight the conflict. And I was one of the few people, hardly few people, who spoke on Swat conflict. Majority of the adults are activists. They took to the height. They didn't want to express because they thought that it's too dangerous to speak. So one, she had a father who was speaking. So this was one thing. Other was that when as they banned girls' education, so the journalists were so much interested in schools and in children's stories to listen from teachers directly. And then they found me that, okay, this person is speaking himself, his girls, his school girls are also speaking. So many girls were speaking, not only her. Mm. And even for the BBC blog, first I asked the teachers, then a student agreed. Next day her father came, said no. And then she said that, why not I do it? So it was that situation in those circumstances. And I say, like father, like daughter, what I was doing. So she started doing it.
So the Taliban would have noticed her and would have, she was somebody doing what not many people were doing. And so were you, speaking out, saying girls should be educated. This is not right, which was risky, really risky. But you felt, obviously, that somebody had to do it.
Of course. In the beginning years, when she was doing her BBC blog or volunteering herself for the New York Times documentaries, we took it for granted wrongly that Taliban bombed more than 400 schools, they banned girls' education, but they never killed a teacher or a student. So, like, they will not go after a girl or after a child for speaking. We were wrong. We thought that even being the worst people, they will have some ethics even of war and battle. And I mean, terrorism has no ethics. We were wrong. So later on, they proved it by targeting her and by targeting 132 children in Army Public School attack in 2014 and attacking universities after that. It was our miscalculation. Later on, in 2012, that year, in January, February, they issued a threat to her openly and to one other women rights activist that these two are speaking against Taliban and they are speaking for Western education and they have Western agenda and that's why they are on our hit list.
So they came on her bus, they shot Malala, she almost died. It was most horrific day for you, and you recounted in the book. But I suppose the big bit of the book is you having to you coming to live in Birmingham and adjusting to that life there, and Malala now being this public figure. As a parent, obviously the first thing is our daughter is, you know, dying, and it's a very moving part of the book too, where you describe that. Obviously the worst time of your life.
Yes.
But also interesting is how you adapted to this new life too, because she did get better. She incredibly, like, her brain wasn't affected. You know, obviously the side of her face still droops, and the bullet, you know, had some effect. But essentially, her beautiful mind and all the things that she had to offer were still there.
Yeah.
And now you were the father of somebody. Mm. You were always the father of somebody extraordinary, but now this person was out there in the world, and that message of girls' education was amplified to such a huge degree. But a difficult time too, though, for you as a family, coming to a place like Birmingham, where, for example, your wife wasn't able to speak any English, and such a culturally different place. And then your son, one of your sons, wasn't happy about it either.
Yes.
And your relationship with him deteriorated too. So tell me about that time and how you kind of, how it came from, which was quite a very dark time, into this light, really.
Yeah. In both ways, like, it was the most traumatic time in our life. Like, Malala is not only my daughter, she was my comrade, a mission comrade. We were both on this journey and campaign for girls' education, women empowerment. And when you all of a sudden are deprived that beautiful, powerful company, even before Talibanization, we used to go to different villages. I used to meet men, she used to meet girls inside the families, and spreading the word about girls' education.
There's one bit there where you say that she used to tell you about her period pain. She wouldn't tell her mom, she'd tell you.
Yeah.
I find that. I mean, that just shows
the
intensity of your friendship.
Very, very close.
Yeah.
It was the most traumatic and the most difficult time in our lives, but my wife says it very, she's very articulate in expressing it. And when I was sad, when we came, she was herself very sad and very homesick. But she one day told me that, just imagine that if we were not in the UK, we were back in Swat Valley without Malala being existing in this world. What would have been you thinking and living life like? And that thought, having life without our beloved daughter, I mean, it is a blessing that we were in the UK. Mm. She was safe. She came back to life. So the end story is gratitude, to be honest. We will go back to Pakistan one day, of course. It's our country. Birmingham is our second home. We love UK and Birmingham especially. But Pakistan is our first home. And our forefathers and great fathers were living in that country. Even when Pakistan was not there, it came into being in 1947. So we have very deep roots were there. And these are political situations. It will change. We will go back one day. Mm-hmm. But of course, having that most tragic circumstances on one hand, but Malala's recovery, her getting education again, and especially they could attack her physically, but they didn't attack her soul, or they could not attack her soul. They could not hit her soul. Mm. And I was telling somebody now that when she was in the hospital, in the first month she was on bed, and I was very, very worried about the memory she had, that whether she will have the same memory or not. Wisely, I used to check her memory. She's very, like, she might have got that while he is doing that, because she's very wise. But I used to try not to let her know that why I'm doing so. And she had lost most of the English vocabulary and Urdu vocabulary, but she was very good in Pashto vocabulary, in her mother tongue. And I asked her about a Pashto verse, which means that if the men can't do, women will come forward and they will do it. They will accomplish it. And she told me that I was about to change it. And I said, how? It is the collective approved wisdom, this kind of poetry. It is like a proverbial thing. Mm. How do you change it? And she said, no, I wanted to change it. So I said, how? She said, I wanted to write it this way, that if men do or not, we will come and we will accomplish it.
So you knew she was okay.
And I cried because I thought that, she's the same old girl. She's on bed. She has not come out of her trauma.
Amazing.
Her surgeries are yet to be done because that nerve surgery was not done. Cochlear implant was not done. It was the very first month.
So she was already reinventing these things.
And she was raising her voice from her bed.
She was already campaigning and she wasn't well and all these things hadn't happened.
Yeah.
I could talk to you about so much more, but the book essentially, I think it's a really good parenting manual. Can I say that? I don't know if anyone said that to you yet, but
I must say that I have just shared my lessons which I have learned myself. I'm not a preacher, but I just shared what I
that's what I mean
through.
I mean, your son really resented you because there was all this focus on Malala. He really wasn't happy with that, which you can understand. Also wasn't the same kind of person, and when he came to England they played video games a lot. They'd be up in their room and you couldn't
he broke eight
controllers. You couldn't handle this, but you had to learn how to accept the fact that this was his way of transitioning. And as beautiful thing that your younger son says about his relationship with Malala, but not resenting her, that he feels like he's in Malala's classroom almost, that he learns so much from his sister.
Yes.
And that was such a beautiful moment. But you do quote, and it's funny because when I had my daughters, somebody framed these words for me and gave them to me 9 years ago. My daughters were born and you put them in the book, Khalil Gibran.
He
says, your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you.
Exactly.
They are with you, yet they belong not to you.
Exactly.
And I think
Khalil Gibran is beautiful.
Amazingly beautiful. I mean, that shines through in the book so much.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now, there's a couple of things I need to ask you before you go. I'm interested in your wife's sort of feminist journey too, because Malala and your wife both wear headscarves still, which is an issue and it's something that people have an issue with. Why should women have to cover their heads? What's your own take on that?
Yeah, I mean, we in the West, sometime we misunderstand many things. It will be the same question from the Eastern world or from the East, I can say. I don't believe in this distribution of East or West, but kind of societies who are more conservative about clothing. It will be the same question when it is asked that why people in Europe are wearing less clothes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So it's the same thing. I will tell you an interesting story. This freedom should be natural. It should take a natural course. It should be up to the wishes of the girls themselves. During the conflict of Swat, two women journalists came to Swat, and they were my guests at my home. I think they were from Austria. And we were sitting in a room. My wife was there and they were sitting and we were talking about Swat and women's rights and girls' education. And they told me all of a sudden that, you people, why do you control your women and your wife is wearing this scarf and why you impose this on her? And I told them, just wait. And what I did, I just removed the scarf from my wife and she just screamed, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? So I told them, look, I mean, I encourage her that she should do things in her life, but traditionally she's more comfortable with the scarf. Mm. So if I impose it on her that, we are liberals so-called and we are progressive and we have made a great development in this and thing and we believe in human rights and the scarf is not a right. So it is a right to wear or not to wear. So going to that extent, it is kind of liberal extremism, to be honest. Mm. Like imposing in the name of freedom or liberty, imposing things on women in the East.
Mm.
I mean, it's not a wise thing. Mm. And we should understand that sometime, like many people in the West, I mean, most of them, they don't men don't cover their head. Heads are open. Yeah. I mean, they don't cover their hair. But if you go to Swat Valley, I mean, I can say 98% of men, they have capes on their heads.
Okay.
So if you say, oh, this cape is not good. This is not something that shows a progress. It is like a retrogression. I mean, it is not a good and fair judgment about the cultural aspects of a society. I'm only against all those cultural taboos and social norms that goes against the basic human rights. Mm-hmm. Of the
Fair
people.
Enough. So if Malala didn't want
and
to wear her scarf...
Otherwise, it is diversity. We love it.
If Malala didn't want to wear her scarf, you wouldn't care.
It's up to... Oh, one day she...
I think one day she
was in school. No.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a story. She was in high school before college. And she called me from school. And she told me, Abba, father, I have sports. And during sports, my scarf just goes down. And what should I do? And you know what was my answer, sir? She's so respectful to me. And I told her that, look, Jani, it is your head and your scarf.
Okay,
I have nothing to do with it.
Brilliant.
But now, at that time, she was asking. Now she is not asking even.
No, she wouldn't be asking
when she was
anything.
Going to the university a few days ago, from going to university, she told me, we were sitting at the table and she will be going to college after 2-3 days. And she told me, Abba, you know, now I'm leaving for Oxford and the life will be different. I'll be inviting friends and there may be men. What do you think? And I told her, Jani, I trust you. And what did she say? Don't trust me. Because
listen,
she knew that it carries a baggage.
Yeah. One so, last thing, because we have
okay,
to end,
sorry.
But I could speak to you all
I
day.
I love talking to you so much.
I really enjoy it.
I just speak and speak. Okay.
Just what's the message you'd like people to get from the book? The message of your story and the journey you've taken with Malala and with your whole family. What would you like people to be left
to
with?
To be very short, I must say, educate your daughters, sisters, girls, and let them fly.
Okay. That's very short. And I just want to tell you one little thing before we go.
Yeah.
I was in the car going on a long car journey with my daughters and they were complaining so much about having to go to school the next day. Oh my goodness, it was so annoying. For 10 minutes they did, I hate school, I don't want to go back, blah, blah, blah. And I said to them, okay, you stay silent now for a moment. I'm going to play you something. I put on Malala's Nobel Prize winning speech
okay.
on the radio.
Oh my God.
And they had to sit there. And they listened to this thing. They listened to the whole thing. I don't know how long it is. It's probably 13 minutes or something.
Yeah.
And at the end, that was it.
Oh
they
God.
Said, okay, Mom, I understand. School is good. I am lucky to go to school. I
yes.
get it. Oh, God,
yes,
did you have
yes,
to?
Yes.
So we always mentioned it. And my daughter just did a big project about Malala,
yeah.
which she was trying to find last night for me to bring to you. But, you know, just to say...
I must tell you that girls and boys in these countries, whether they are in UK or Ireland, wherever... they must value their education. Mm. There are hundreds and thousands of girls and boys in Syria, in African countries, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Nigeria, who struggle every day to have an access to education.
Exactly.
So this is so important.
Yeah.
This
I tell them about
everything.
It's such a privilege.
And I hope that my message goes to every girl and every boy of Ireland. That they will love education.
Brilliant.
Because it builds them, it builds their families, and it builds their countries and nations.
Okay, well, that's a beautiful way to end. Zayauddin Yousafzai, right. I'm very pleased to meet you again, and maybe you'll come back again to see us with Malala, and we can get her side of the story
Thank
the next
you.
Time.
Hope to see you again.
Thank you.
Inshallah. Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Thanks to Zayuddin Yousafzai for speaking to me. And just a reminder that his really brilliant book, Let Her Fly, is out now. I really recommend it. It's a great read and actually a great read to give to any young women in your life too, because it's so inspiring. Remember, you can subscribe to Roisin Meets wherever you get your podcasts and you can always find us on irishtimes.com. Today's podcast was produced by Jennifer Ryan with JJ Vernon on sound. I'm Roisin Ingle and I'll talk to you next time.